Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
All right, here we go. Quiet! Quiet! Problem!
You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Mr. Allen, this may come as a shock to you, but there are some men who don't end every sentence with a proposition.
All right, I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
I don't like that music anymore. Mind if I close the window?
Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
Well, here's another nice mess you've gotten me into.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Many thanks to Ian for the past 2 hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, heavyweight film reviews in the slimming stripes of radio. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this afternoon are Bridget Bradshaw.
Hello.
Eleanor Franks.
Hello.
And Lorcan O'Neill.
Hello.
We've a little bit of a mixed bag today. Review-wise, we'll be looking at Mary Shelley, which has the head of an old-fashioned romance sewn to the body of a traditional biopic. Pixar Studios brings back the superheroes with Incredibles 2. And Paul Schrader, one of the most interesting American filmmakers of the past few decades, returns with the transcendental drama First Reformed. Plus, we've repeats of two of our most interesting recent features, Rebecca Harrison of Glasgow University on the female projectionists of World War II, and we talk to Oliver Stockman, head of the legendary costume department of Sans Film. So, all that to come, but first, we're feeling simply super.
It's time to make some wrong things right. Help me bring supers back into the sunlight. Change people's perceptions about superheroes, and Elastigirl is our best play.
Better than me?
You know it's crazy, right? To help my family, I gotta leave it. To fix the law, I gotta break it.
You've got to, so our kids can have that choice.
Thank you, young man.
Combustion imminent? What does that mean?
Ah! It means fire, Robert.
The screen slater interrupts this program for an important announcement.
This summer has already seen well over 30 superheroes battle it out for supremacy on the big screen, but they all seem like wannabes next to the starling grace of the Parr family, the suburban superhuman stars of Pixar's The Incredibles 2. It's been 14 years since the first film, but the sequel, once again written and directed by Brad Bird, wastes no time swinging into action with Mr. Incredible, Elastigirl, and their three children making short work of supervillain The Underminer. But the big battle leaves the city in tatters, and the super family once again find themselves ostracized by society. Facing an uncertain financial future, the family take up an offer from a telecommunications giant who want Elastigirl, voiced again by Holly Hunter, to front a campaign to make superheroes legal again. Bridget, Brad Bird, whenever he was asked, when he was on the tours for Tomorrowland or Mission Impossible, they said, will you make Incredibles 2? I will make Incredibles 2 when I have a story for Incredibles 2. He's made Incredibles 2. Did he have a story worth telling?
It was certainly full of lots of great fun bits and lots of... there's lots of themes that seem very relevant today about doing good and evil and how to protect each other. I didn't care that much about the story, but I really enjoyed just sitting there and watching the film and having them take us through all of this journey. There's a lot of bits that seemed... there were a lot of echoes of different aspects. Like, there's a bit with a sort of rich family whose parents were killed when they were young, and I thought, is this going to be a Batman reference? Is it going to go that direction? But it kept playing with us.
It kept playing with us, which I think is the strength of Brad Bird. He's aware of whether his film is Ratatouille or The Iron Giant, he's aware of when his scripts might tread dangerously near the cliché, and he always manages to pull them back, even if that sometimes means some weird tonal issues, like Tomorrowland. Eleanor, is that... Bridget hinted at a problem there, or a possible problem, in that Brad Bird had certain elements that were left over from the first film. The raccoon fight, there's a big scene in the middle, towards the middle, where the baby, Jack-Jack, who has amazing powers...
Yeah.
fights a raccoon. It's a very, very funny scene, but it's almost a Looney Tunes cartoon in the middle of The Incredibles. Does the film feel a little bit disjointed because it's a lot of ideas?
Well, sitting in the cinema on a Friday night, 7:30, I absolutely loved it, and I came away thinking, oh, this is just as good as the first one. This is so brilliant. But, you know, we've just had a chat before the show, and perhaps picking it apart, it has got that, you know, it has got that problem that it's got lots of good bits, but does it really add up to a whole? The first Incredibles film was a really good whole, and I'm not sure, actually really thinking about it, that it does have that
coherence.
Yeah,
is that Lorcan, is that down to the villain? Even though the first film, the villain was found quite late in the script writing process, but Syndrome felt like a natural extension of the themes of The Incredibles, in that, you know, if you're special, you should do something. If you're not special, you should stand aside. It's a strange theme for a family film, but he lines up with that. In this, Screenslaver, even the name sounds like it was made up by a focus group. Does the villain, as a villain, do they work? And is that the reason why the film just feels like a lot of very, very good set pieces?
Well, the problem is there's no discernible theme. I feel like the film wants to be various different things at very different parts of the film. I'm not the biggest fan of Pixar to begin with, but I like how they haven't done the thing that literally every other animated film does, which is just have a bunch of Minions-type characters running around so they can sell as toys. So I was a little disheartened whenever so much of the film is just kind of sides, especially about the baby, like you mentioned. Like, there's a cartoon within the cartoon that's just like 5 minutes of a baby fighting a raccoon, and there's lots of babies doing this, babies doing that, and it's all cute and it's all very clever, it's all very funny, but it doesn't lead anywhere, it doesn't have anything
Well, we've had this discussion off air, and I'm quite willing to continue this discussion now.
Yeah.
In that the baby's powers, Jack-Jack's powers, which we know from the first film he has lots of powers, but the Parr family didn't see that, weren't privy to the information the audience has. So these powers that Jack-Jack have are a development from Mr. Incredible and Elastigirl. And I think the fact that Elastigirl doesn't know the baby has powers because she's on a mission and is important to the theme, the many themes of the film. Plus, Jack-Jack's powers play a role in the very end. And I think it's woven in well enough. But I take your point that they are sort of... we probably could have done... The scene with the raccoon is doubled up several times with other scenes.
Yes.
No, I think we had just the right amount of baby. Maybe we should have had more babies.
Again, I think the baby...
Sometimes we do have more babies.
I think the baby bits are like some of the best bits in the film. The problem is the plot doesn't make any sense, for one thing. Like, I felt it was very obvious who the villain was right from the get-go. And, I mean, can we go into like what the villain's plot was?
I think it was because it's an interesting film and it's a very Pixar... it's a very Brad Bird film, in the fact that I can't quite work out who it's for. It's obviously a brilliant children's film because the action is spectacular and it's very funny, but thematically, it's on wavelengths I don't think the general audience is interested in, which culminated, as you say, in the ending of the film and those things.
Yeah, I think the film was a bit too long, and like the ending just kind of, nothing felt like it came together, and the ending just kind of goes on for a while. And there's lots of like plot threads that just kind of don't go anywhere. Like the Underminer fight at the start of the film, like he gets away with the loot, never comes back into the film.
Oh, that's like, fine. That you've just got to I'm sorry, carry on. This is not the hill I'm going
to
die on.
Again, there's lots of things that I felt like you need to do something at the end to kind of tie everything in a bit of a bow. And like they introduce kind of like gender politics, and then that's kind of dropped halfway through.
Representation as well.
Yeah, yeah. And then like Violet's, the daughter's relationship with her wannabe boyfriend, that's just kind of there and doesn't really go anywhere. And this, every so often someone would come up and say, oh, they're going to do something with this, and then they kind of drop it. But, I mean, it is an incredibly fun movie. All the action is very well done and entertaining. It's just, it's not the right plot, I don't think.
Tonally as well, with the visuals, it looks so different when they are fighting crime in the cities, because it all looks like these glorious, glowing sort of coral colours of old pulp paintings, and it seems like such a different environment from their home.
It is, and the fight. Sorry, Eleanor.
I just wanted to put in. You were talking about disparate elements earlier. Was anyone else incredibly disturbed by the character Reflux, whose superpower is that he can sort of bring up hot lava?
Regurgitate hot lava.
He wasn't in the first one, was he?
No, all the superheroes. Because when they make superheroing legal again, all these superheroes come out of hiding.
Very disturbed by Reflux.
It was again.
Very odd.
More disturbed by the hero who was just a man owl who could turn his head 360 degrees.
It reminded me of Mystery Men when they're all coming up with their superpowers, which aren't really superpowers.
Yeah.
It is. Themes, the sort of the mess of the themes aside, I think it. I don't want to have a dig at Marvel films, but I think this film obviously it's an animation, so they can do a lot more for a little bit less. But this film is much better than most of the superhero films, almost all of them, in showing what superheroes can do. This feels much more like a comic book that's come to life in terms of the ingenuity of the action scenes, I felt. Did it ever get confusing? Was it always sort of, you could tell where everybody is? Because Brad Bird's quite famous for his action direction.
I think, I thought it was pretty clear-cut, and I think one of the benefits of using a CGI animation and telling a superhero film is that a big problem with superhero films is you struggle to get involved sometimes because it is a mix of real sets, and then you've just got all these kind of CGI.
It would go into a cartoon.
You can't really mix the two, but here it's like there's a phenomenal bit where Elastigirl's chasing helicopters, and she like rings her arms up around this like advertisement, and she like swings herself over it and through the sky and lands on the helicopter. Because it's all CGI and we follow her as she does this, it's much more involving and impressive and entertaining than it would be in like a live action mixed with CGI film.
And it's actually weirdly, because the way Brad Bird uses the camera, it's much more live action than something in the Avengers might be, where they don't treat the camera like a live action camera. When it cuts to an action scene, suddenly it's a weightless camera in a CGI environment. Here, Brad Bird's doing almost the opposite. It's a CGI environment that he's stapling down by treating the camera as a live action camera. So it helps. I think a lot of filmmakers could learn from how he handles the action scene. Edna Mode, last question. Edna Mode's back in this. We heard her in the trailer. Is it just fan service that she comes back in? Or is it worthwhile? Does she serve a plot point? Because again, it's with Jack.
I like fan service. It is fun. I enjoyed it.
She's just as good as she is in the first film, which is amazing.
Okay, I'm just worried. Sometimes these sequels bring other characters in and, you know, and it's just there's no need for it. Okay. The Incredibles 2 opened yesterday and is now showing at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a certificate PG. Our first repeat feature comes from 2016 when we spoke to Oliver Stockman, head of the costume department at Legendary Sans Films. Located in a rambling warehouse on the banks of the River Thames, Sans Films has been in business since 1975. Their costume department has work threaded throughout the last 40 years of cinema. Bright Star, Gangs of New York, Pride and Prejudice, The Other Boleyn Girl, Lincoln, Love and Friendship, all featured period dresses, suits, jackets, boots, hats, and even underwear, carefully sewn together by Sans Films. 2 years ago, Oliver Stockman came to community cinema Saffron Screen for a Q&A after a special charity screening of Love and Friendship, and he was also kind enough to sit down with me and reveal the role of the film costume department, beginning with a relationship period film costumes have with reality.
Our perception of the past, or our interpretation of the past, keep on changing. So what people perceive as being realistic, it looks credible, but it's not necessarily historically accurate. It's just how it fits in our perception of our interpretation of the past. There are moments in history, in art history, where people think we have to be faithful to the past in a certain way, and a certain naturalistic approach is used to give something which is more historically accurate than not. This is probably very true of the end of the 20th century, but now, in the 21st century, the things like love and friendship are not historically accurate. They are quite free with the reality.
At what stage of a film's production, after you've been hired and contracted, do you begin working with that film's designer?
In the case of Sans Films has been going on for 40 years, so it's a very well-established company. It is a collaborative work, and there is two levels of collaboration. One is the ongoing process of knowing designers for many years, and they come back, and you know the designer come to us specifically for certain things, and they may even, in the same way, avoid us for specific, you know, if they want to do certain things, they'll come to us for that, knowing that that's what we'll deliver, but they'll go elsewhere for something else. And then there is the other aspect, which is working specifically for one project. That side of it changes, and currently in the film industry it's changing dramatically because it's getting shorter and shorter. Typically in the, you know, olden days, people would prepare a film for 12 weeks or so, maybe sometimes more if it's a big project, where there'll be a period of designing and then starting to make costume, do prototypes, and then fittings, and then, you know. This period of production is now being eroded, partly because people are making more and more films and they are being made cheaper and cheaper. And because of that, that period of preparation is shrinking dramatically. So now, you know, we're lucky if we get 3 weeks prep on a project. Very often they go ahead with a film, they don't have the finished script, they don't have the cast. Love and Friendship is one of those, you know, where basically you start and there's nothing in place, and there's no actors, nothing. You just go ahead completely in the dark.
With costumes, I wondered if, as well as creating a correct sense of period, whether it was also partly giving the actors their first few steps into a performance. It was part of who they would be.
Yes, you're right. A lot of people think of costumes purely as providing a prop, if you like, just providing a piece of dressing. But in reality, what it is that it is the only piece of equipment that the actor actually has to create a character. And in the costume industry, there's a couple of things which are very interesting. It's the fact that very often the director of the film don't come for the first fitting. It's very often a relationship purely between the actor and the designer, and it's really for the actor to try and find where the persona of the character is. When we did Mr. Turner, for instance, that was very, very fascinating because Mike Lee, because he works with the actors without a script, there isn't this technical process of breaking down the script and then saying, we need a dressing gown, we need an evening suit, we need this, we need that. And so it's down to the actor to work out what they might need. What is this guy wearing? What is Mr. Turner wearing? You know, what does he wear when he paints? What does he wear when he goes to bed? And it's, this process is obviously very exciting, and that draws, you know, points to what you just said, which is that the costume is a tool for the actor.
Good day to you, sir.
And a very good day to you, Mrs. D.
And how do we find you on this fair morning?
Exceedingly preoccupied, madam.
Was ever thus? You've always been preoccupied. You're too preoccupied for your own good, sir. Evelina, Georgiana, come and greet your father.
Good day, father.
You do your own cutting, you do your own fitting, you've even got your own workshop for dyeing. But do you create all the parts of a costume for yourself? So if there's buttons, or I was wondering if there was a whole range of specialised industries that you still can draw on, and if they're dwindling now.
We do a lot of things at Sans Films, and one of the things that Sans Films is known for is to try to reflect the technology of the time. So if things were made in a certain way in the 1830, we try to duplicate that way it was made, because that is the surest way to have something which accurately falls and gives the feeling of that period. This is what is consistent or special, specific to Sans. And because of that, Sans Films will do things like buttons, will do things like shoes or hats or things. So we do, and we try to understand the process that those things were made to duplicate their looks.
Are you the gift, my gracious little man?
No, no, my most majestic majesty. I am a free man. My gift is a play.
The other thing is for the actors. I mean, the thing we mentioned earlier on about the reality of the costumes as clothes rather than costumes is very important. It's a silly anecdote, but when we did the costume for Elizabeth I, for Vanessa Redgrave on Anonymous, she wanted to have crotchless bloomers because the Queen had bloomers like that. And you think it's very, very extreme because they're not seen in the film, of course. But the actress, Vanessa Redgrave, wanted them to feel like the Queen would have felt. In the industry, we're known for something a little bit. We're known to be organic and gritty and that kind of, that feel. So, for instance, if you take a thing like Far From Madden Crowd, Jan Patterson asked us to do all the farmers, obviously herself, we do her as a farm lady, but then she went to another costumier for what she perceived as being smart and being fashionable and maybe what is perceived to be more artificial, more formal. On a film like Young Victoria, Sandy Powell asked us to do all the men. And then she went to all the women, to somebody else. So it's what the designer thinks of what would fit their own idea of the film. It's a bit, it's like a piece of casting.
That's, I was going to say, you're being picked as an actor.
Yeah, yeah. It's for the atmosphere and the spirit that we bring.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many thanks to Oliver Stockman for the interview. One reason we replayed the interview with Sands Films is because Sands Films once produced a film of their own, Little Dorrit, made in 1987, and a brilliant masterpiece adaptation of Charles Dickens. It's not available on DVD or Blu-ray, but it has rather incredibly just popped up on Netflix, and it's well worth seeing. If you can sit through 8 hours of a superhero wandering down corridors, you can certainly sit through Little Dorrit. It's a masterpiece.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Cambridge has a vibrant food and drink scene. On Flavour, we talk with a wide range of food and drink producers. We visit cafes, restaurants, pubs, and independent food stores. We find out what's new and what's good. We review the food items in the papers. If it's about food and drink, if it's local and good, it's on Flavour. Alternate Saturdays, 12 till 1, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
To catch up with one of your favourite shows or interviews, listen to a variety of them again on our website. Find out what's best on the food and drink scene in Cambridge with Flavour, film reviews with Bums on Seats, or the best of the guests from 105 Daytime. Those and many more are available to download now at cambridge105.fm.
You are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Still to come on the show, we have a repeat of our feature on the training of female projectionists during the Second World War, plus a review of Paul Schrader's First Reformed. But before that, we've history's greatest monster.
Who amongst you has ever wondered if the dead could return to life?
Is that really possible? Reanimation.
We've been invited to Geneva by Lord Byron.
Would you like to join me in the parlour, Miss Goldwyn?
I have no quarrel with you becoming lovers.
Do you wish to be with someone else?
I no longer see the world and its works as they before appeared to me, and men appear to me as monsters.
We are each to write a ghost story. It's a competition. The woman is not intelligent enough to form ideas of her own.
What's wrong with you?
You, Miss Godwin, have the chance to prove me wrong.
Don't you recognise Victor Frankenstein?
Though the tale of Frankenstein has been adapted or co-opted well over 50 times on film, cinema has been far less interested in the life of Frankenstein's creator, the writer Mary Shelley. The English-language debut of Saudi Arabian director Haifa al-Mansour new release, Mary Shelley, aims to throw light on the writer behind the famous monster. Elle Fanning plays Mary, only 16 years old when we meet her, sitting by the grave of her late mother and writing a blood and thunder ghost story. Like every teenager, she craves adventure and escape, a passion her family planned to dampen by sending her to Scotland. But it is here that she meets Percy Bysshe Shelley. Played by Douglas Booth, Shelley is the toast of the literary scene and the very epitome of the dashingly handsome devil-may-care poet. Eleanor, al-Mansour has said in interviews that she was drawn to directing Mary Shelley because it was a tale of feminism that was still vital. Is that relevance evident, or is it smothered in period movie detail? Because I know that's something that usually sometimes can turn you off if it's
Yeah, I mean, I don't usually like period films, and I've read some reviews. I've got a feeling I'm going to be on my own in the studio. I actually really liked this. I thought they dealt with the feminism very subtly. The one thing they did hammer home a bit hard at the end of the film was the link between Mary Shelley's life and the character of Frankenstein, and they kind of go back to that idea about three times, and by the second or third time I was thinking, yes, I think we've got this. It's a bit like York's notes on the screen. Thank you very much. But no, I thought she did a lovely job, actually, and yeah, I liked it, and I thought the feminism was well done.
Lorcan, it's fascinating. One reason I really wanted to review this film is Mansour. She's a Saudi Arabian female filmmaker, but she's from Saudi Arabia. She has one feature film behind her, and a different eye, an alien eye, is often can show a culture, and we know this period of British history very well. It's often, we had it in The Happy Prince on the last show, often can throw a new light.
Yeah.
Is that something that happens here? Is this?
We had The Limehouse Golem fairly recently, which also had Douglas Booth, and that was directed by Carlos Medina, and he was cast as a director because the producers wanted to have someone who wasn't English, someone foreign, to kind of come in and do their version of kind of a seedy underbelly of London, which I would have hoped for, but I think here there's just a lot of aspects of the filmmaking that are subpar, and in terms of, like, the period aspects, there's a bit at the start where we follow Mary Shelley going past a wall, and then there's this grand sweeping shot of, or establishing shot of this alley set, the street set that they've made.
Yes.
And you can tell they're very, very proud of the street set that they've made. And I was like, oh no, we're going to see the street set a lot throughout the film, I feel. And we do. They dress it up here and there, but it's just like seeing the same street. And then there's...
You're ruining the magic for me.
it's borderline comical, though, because there's every time they show a specific shot of this street, there's this poor prostitute who's standing outside the bar, and she's always in the exact same spot wearing the exact same thing, and it's like, oh, all the business of London just must be focused to this two square
area. It's that French and Saunders sketch where the penny farthing keeps going by the camera because they can only afford one.
So I know, I think in terms of, like, the period aspect, I think you mentioned earlier, like, the staging, I think, was not great, and I think the colors are just a bit drab and the costumes don't quite fit. So I'm not overly impressed in terms of, like, how, like, this era England was, like, brought to life on the screen.
Bridget, there's a luridness in this, especially in this tale, especially obviously in Frankenstein itself. But in the whole holiday that Byron and Shelley and Mary Shelley, though she wasn't Mary Shelley at the time, and they spend by a lake in Geneva, not Lake Geneva, but a lake near Geneva, where these tales arrive fully formed. And Ken Russell's made a film of this evening in Gothic, and as you would imagine with Ken Russell, that's sufficiently lurid. This film just skates by that. Is it debauched enough? Does it feel, because it should have a sort of a teenage energy, perhaps? And again, do the
Yeah, I mean, I was quite disappointed by the film because I've loved the book forever, and she's such a great person and interesting character, and that didn't come across for me. I hadn't realised how young she was at the start of the film, but a lot of the things that could be feminist came across more like a teenage strop against your parents.
I know, it doesn't seem unusual enough, does it?
I mean, surely part of the tragedy is that she is 16, 17, and she gets married, and then she's sort of... that's suffocating. Although, yes, they live this debauched life, she's also tied down and... You know,
but then the director has said that
stifled.
And with the debauchery, we see the other characters doing a lot more things than she does. She seems to be shown to us as much more of a sort of a calm, a good person.
But is she should she be shown as an observer? Because the Mansour said again that the film treats Mary Shelley, is supposed to be treating Mary Shelley, that she couldn't have written Frankenstein without those, or at least written Frankenstein in the form that it took, without those 2 years of travel and experience with Shelley and with Byron and that life. I didn't get that feeling at all. I never felt I knew where Frankenstein came from. There was just flashbacks to this one conference on electricity she attended. And Frankenstein didn't arrive fully formed.
And the loneliness and the ways that her mother's death affected her.
Well, even,
so there were lots of sort of threads all the way through. But she didn't seem to have as much fun.
No, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. And I
mean, there's that fantastic rainstorm in I agree with you about, you know, you kind of get a bit frustrated thinking, I want to see more of her writing. She
writes at the very beginning, and then it sort of...
And then she just writes it, seemingly, over about, you know, takes her about 12 hours to knock out Frankenstein. And then
with a couple of fever dreams to remind us.
Yeah, now I've written, one of the biggest classics of all time.
I've invented science fiction overnight.
you do want to see more of it. But there's, like, the thing in Byron's house in Geneva when there's that massive rainstorm, and that's kind of part of the Frankenstein, you know, the birth of the book.
But it's so... ordinarily filmed, I think that's my problem. Is it? I wanted it to be less anchored in reality. I wanted the film to take flight and to be as silly as it all is.
For this film, I'm not sure that you're the exact target audience for this film. I think the target audience for this film is going to be content with something more, you know, something quieter than what you're.
But you can do more, as we found with The Happy. I agree with you that. They're probably not after the same audience that went to see Ken Russell's Gothic, but and what films are now for that audience. But as we found with The Happy Prince, the Oscar Wilde biopic, which is no great shakes, but is a much more adventurous film visually than this is. It takes more, it challenges its audience a little bit more within the framework of a period film that you might find on a Sunday evening. Lorcan,
you want more kind of like genuine, like truthfulness, and it, I think films in general just should be engaging to the audience. Films can have like be targeted to a specific people, but like in terms of like general audience.
I think what I liked about it is that I felt I was learning from the film. I felt I was learning a lot about Mary Shelley and the story. And
but I mentioned earlier, the film does kind of feel like a Wikipedia narrative, where it's just kind of a lot of facts. It's just like this happened and this happened and this happened.
And that can be a bit reductive. I'm sure it's true to an extent, but Mary Shelley losing her first child and that death. And then hinging that death to the creation of a novel about rebirth all feels a little bit reductive. Like she could only have written this woman. It makes her too much of a woman first rather than a writer. I know they're intermingled, but
for a biopic, it's like kind of uneven and a little unfocused because I wasn't really sure. Some parts are like I spend a lot of time on like Percy and Mary's relationship, and then some parts are vaguely inspiration for Frankenstein, and some parts are kind of like dealing with grief, and then some parts are like focusing on like her relationship with her father, and like, but there's like, it's very episodic thematically almost, which like it spends large chunks dealing with like I say like Percy and Mary, and then a large chunk just dealing with like Frankenstein. It got to the point where I didn't even think they were going to do anything with Frankenstein,
which would have been interesting actually.
She's got the idea,
that would have been, I think, preferable. Or a film about her problems struggling to publish it, under her own name. There were lots of other slightly more interesting avenues, perhaps. Yeah. That would have been less biopic-y, maybe. I don't know.
Melodramatic.
But I don't want to talk over Eleanor's liking the film, because I think that's... I'm programmed to dislike something so I can make something of the show.
I think, you know, maybe the fact that I don't like period films, I haven't seen a lot, meant I had my eyes a bit more, you know, I was a bit, I don't know.
Then you didn't know very much about Mary, this that obviously that helped, whilst I didn't know anything either, actually, to be fair.
I was hoping to come away inspired to be more like Mary Shelley, because she's an amazing woman, and I just wasn't. By this film.
I've done a lot of grave robbing and have started sewing corpses together. That's how the film's influenced me. Okay, all right. Thank you, Bridget. Sorry, I didn't mean that. I never learn. Never learn. Anyway, Mary Shelley opened last week and is still showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 12A.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
For the second of our two repeat features, so much of the show that I just regret in the pub afterwards, my bits of the show, they're the bits I regret. For the second of our two repeat features, we're playing again our interview with Dr. Rebecca Harrison, lecturer in film and TV at the University of Glasgow. Among many studies and papers, Ms. Harrison has written extensively on how, during World War II, the enlistment of so many men left Britain's cinemas understaffed in the crucial department of film projection. Highly technical and labour-intensive, the job of film projectionist was, of course, considered an entirely male preserve, but in order to keep films showing, cinemas had to, reluctantly, hire and train women. To find out more about this little documented area of cinema history, I spoke to Rebecca, who first explained about what made up the daily routine of the cinema projectionist in the 1930s.
Projectionist jobs were actually incredibly varied. So I think we tend to think of just one person being in the box, projecting a reel of film, or kind of doing a changeover and there being a couple of reels of film on the go. But actually that was, from what we can work out from the records, a really tiny part of their job. They were also responsible for a whole host of other things. So they would be handling and caring for all the films. So that would include splicing all the reels together to make up the film into one, mending the film, any tears or perforations, making sure they were kept clean because they would often end up with big sort of smudges and fingerprints and so on them. They'd have to rewind them at the end of every show.
So there was this crisis that when war broke out and men were conscripted, that these roles needed to be filled, as many roles did, but they needed to be filled with women. How did the industry sort of deal with that?
Initially, not very well. I think there was a kind of moment of panic in 1939, 1940, when the industry sort of lost its head a bit, as it were. There was a sense that women might be able to take on the role of the projectionist, but it was a really highly skilled position, and it often would take maybe kind of 3 or 4 years of intensive training, with men moving up through the ranks of, you know, third assistant, second, then first projectionist, and then chief. And I think people just didn't know quite how to respond or how to get people into those kind of more senior positions quickly.
Were there crash courses for the women that they needed to go into these roles? How did they train?
Some of the independent cinemas just kind of kept themselves to themselves, would get women in and create intensive training programs for them. But then other companies, Gaumont, for example, set up schools which were far more regulated and had proper curriculums so that women would graduate with a certificate after, you know, 3 months and be able to go and work in practically any projection booth.
How did that change the working environment in the cinemas? Were they already in managerial positions, or was it just very much usherettes?
Before the war, women were largely confined to the kind of the auditorium, the lobby, and women's bathrooms, and they didn't really have much access to the rest of the cinema. So as soon as women start going into the operator's room, the rewind room, the kind of electrical supply units and spaces, suddenly the whole cinema is being inhabited by women. So I think it was quite a profound change.
Were they working unsupervised? Did they ever move up to, you mentioned the hierarchy of the projection booth. Were they ever trained up to the position of chief?
Well, that's actually really interesting, because according to all the official records and all of the material that we found in the trade press, no, they couldn't possibly become a chief projectionist. Slowly throughout the war, as more and more people were being conscripted, women did slowly move up the ladder. So initially they could only qualify as thirds. By the end of the war, they could be first. So that meant they could be alone in the projection box, but a chief projectionist who was a man had to be on site somewhere.
What was, you mentioned the reaction to the cinema industry, but what was the reaction to the sort of paraphernalia around it? Were women in these roles belittled? Were they sexualized in the way that the trade press tends to treat any women moving into new positions?
Oh, absolutely. At the start of the war, particularly, any of the women entering the box were highly sexualized and really demeaned in terms of the work that they were doing. However, by the end of the war, when women are also being conscripted and taken off into other kind of nationally vital industries, everyone's tone starts to change slightly and they start to recognize women's importance. So instead of being girls, they become women. They're not so often referred to as projectionettes anymore. And they're starting to be taken more seriously. So you see more pictures of them in their, you know, utilitarian wartime overalls and hard hats.
After the war, and when there was demobilization, I'm presuming, obviously, the cinema industry reverted to type and just hire back the men. Is there any historical evidence of women being kept on or being able to use these skills elsewhere? Because, of course, now they had certificates, they had training.
But this is really fascinating because we've actually found evidence that there's lots and lots of women still working in projection after the war. So, again, with fellow researchers at the University of Warwick, we've actually been able to locate some of these women and interview them. And it seems like although there weren't any official figures or statistics or any kind of network linking all these women up, so they often didn't know that one another existed, there were actually quite a few women still hidden away in the box. So I've already mentioned Florence Barton, for example, who carried on working, you know, for decades after the Second World War. And another woman that we spoke to recently, Joan Pearson, who actually didn't even become a projectionist until after the Second World War had ended. So there's a number of these cases, and we think that there are probably even more. These are just anecdotal. And I think it's actually really interesting if you think we don't often see the projectionists because they're concealed. If you see the projectionist, you think they're probably doing their job wrong. But next time you're at the cinema, it's just interesting to think about who actually might be hidden away in the box and the fact that it might be a woman.
Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many thanks to Rebecca Harrison for the interview. We end the show with a slow burn drama of First Reformed, released this week and marking a very welcome return for writer-director Paul Schrader, who you may know as he's the writer of Last Temptation of Christ, the screenwriter of Last Temptation of Christ and Taxi Driver, and the writer-director of Blue Collar, Autofocus, American Gigolo. But this is his first film in the cinema since Autofocus, which is 2002. Anyway, First Reformed focuses on the Reverend Ernst Toller, played by Ethan Hawke, a preacher at a historical church in a small industrial town in Upper New York State. The Reverend is tiring. His congregation has found salvation at a fancier church just down the road. He has ailments that worry his doctor, and he still grieves over the loss of his son in the Iraq War. Then a young woman, Mary, played by Amanda Seyfried, asks for his help with her husband, whose environmental radicalism seems to be edging towards violence.
Explosives.
She was becoming someone I didn't know.
Opportunistic diseases, anarchy, martial law. You will live to see this.
You had no idea that he was thinking of...
No, I'm so frightened.
These kids, they want certainty. You know, don't think, follow. They fall prey to extremism.
It's a world without hope.
No, I have not lost my faith.
You think that what we did together was a sin?
I've seen enough real sin to know the difference.
You didn't tell the police, right?
Take a look at your own life before you criticize others.
These are frightening times. We have to be patient.
Well, somebody has to do something.
Are you washed?
Are you washed?
In the blood.
In the blood.
In the soul
cleansing blood of the Lamb. Are your garments spotless? Are they white?
Hands shake as I write these lines.
Lorcan First Reformed is, by design, as Paul Schrader says, it's a film that leans away from you, that keeps you at a distance. Ethan Hawke's performance keeps you at a distance. There's nothing easily graspable here. It's, how did you find it? I mean,
it's Paul Schrader certainly climbed back to the top of his like helter skelter of a career. I don't think it's a coincidence that his best work, writing Taxi Driver, writing Raging Bull, Bringing Out the Dead, feels like it's coming from someone who's like absolutely has to write to survive. I found a lot of similarities between this and Hereditary in terms of how it was filmed, where while it does keep you at a distance, all of the camera angles are just like locked down, and you feel like you're trapped in rooms with these people that are very unnerving. And it is just unnerving, like the slow burn, how the tension, how the camera just sits there and lets these characters be themselves and kind of lure you in.
They're very flat. What it does the same thing as Hereditary in that because it has a planimetric composition scheme, everything seems like a doll's house slightly, which is obviously deliberate.
But it just makes you feel like you're sitting in a room with these people, and you really don't want to be sitting in a room with these people. No matter how bleak or nihilistic the drama, dialogue, and narration get, it never feels amateurish or adolescent, as some of the subject matter in the film could come across as, because in part you feel Paul Schrader is like really putting his soul on paper here, much like his main character, Reverend Toller.
Eleanor, I'll ask you the same thing, really. Is it a film? It's a film, again, it's a film that leans away from you, but I know, speaking to you afterwards, that you found a lot to enjoy here. And I mean, it's actually, even Lorcan didn't mention, it's actually a strangely funny film in many ways as well.
Yeah. I mean, the first 15, 20 minutes, maybe the first half hour, I found it quite hard going. It's, you know, it's just plodding along. Not really not plodding along, but, you know, it's just going.
Matter of fact.
And then there's a joke told by a man who's visiting the church, and then in the next scene there's some music, and the film just completely springs to life, and from then on it's just I don't know that I'd agree with you about the distance. I didn't feel particularly distant from the film. I know Ethan Hawke's performance is quite brooding. No, I didn't feel particularly hugely distanced from the film. What it did remind me, I don't know if this is a lazy comparison, it reminded me a bit of the film Magnolia, the sort of, not surrealism, but, you know, I thought they had some common themes running through them.
Bridget, again, I'll come to you, but I'll focus on Ethan Hawke, because we spoke before the show that you found his character, the Reverend Toller, difficult to engage with, which again is deliberate on Schrader's part, that he doesn't give anything. There's only one scene where there's an emotional moment from him. Otherwise, it's a performance of straight lines, deliberately so. Could you get past that, or did you need something that was a little bit more, not melodramatic, but a little bit edging towards that for you to feel his plight?
Yes, I did find him incredibly difficult to know. And I was a bit misled, because I like to go along with the film and what the film's trying to tell me. And it says right at the beginning with the diary that he's going to be completely honest. And when he then turns out to be lying to himself and putting a different face on things, I found that really difficult to assimilate all the things I knew about him.
Because when he sets up, he's doing what anybody does, especially a person in his position, when he starts to write this diary for 1 year, he's thinking he'll tell the truth, but he's human.
And I got really angry with him for all the ways in which he wasn't telling himself the truth.
In which all the ways he was
doctor's appointments. He wasn't
being this slightly Christ-like figure that he was unknowingly starting to portray himself, starting to believe himself as. It's bringing the Christ-like figure to Lorcan. This isn't, again, when you look at the trailer, obviously they're slightly trying to sell it as a horror film, which it isn't, but I can imagine another director would have made this film about a loss of faith. I'm having trouble with words today. A loss of faith. He loses his son in the Iraq War, and where is my God now? He's a man of steady faith all the way through. He just doesn't have a direction for it. I felt that leads the film into lots of fascinating things, and is the bridge really to the radicalism that he then starts to develop in the second half of the film.
I really love the I love the film goes to very painful lengths to propose this kind of tragic theme of that we need equal parts despair and hope to survive on the planet. And I think there's a really clever repetition of a line, will God forgive us? And that perfectly sums up the kind of despair of what we've done to the planet and what we kind of are as a species, and hope that somehow, somewhere, someone might be willing to forgive us. If even that's kind of, if that's even not just Ethan Hawke's, what's transferring his own personal guilt onto a subject matter that he has absolutely no control over.
He had no previous interest in.
No.
He has no previous interest in the damage being done to the environment until, and it's quite extraordinary, because when he meets a character who is radicalized on this to the point of almost violence, and it hinges to him almost like a virus. It comes on and says, "You need, this is your direction now," and he goes on the internet, and it's almost a bit, yeah, bit like a Liam Neeson thriller for a moment. Schrader's playing with all that deliberately. He goes on, he learns these things, he finds how to do certain violent acts.
Our main character knows that he needs hope, but he keeps just digging in this well of despair. Like, it's I loved it.
We just had a film in The Fade on the last show which looked at a grief that propels a character to becoming or almost becoming a suicide bomber. This does something I found even more interesting, in that he's coming from a realistic place. His anger, when he finally finds something to be genuinely angry about, is worth being angry about.
Yeah, I mean, he finds some pictures, and they're, you know, I think we've all seen the picture of the seabird with its all stomach plastic in its stomach, but actually the film presents these pictures and these facts that we're probably all aware of. It presents them to you again, and I think there's also quite a strong, almost an environmental theme in the film, that you kind of start looking at these and thinking, he's got a point.
But he could be angry about anything. This is just the latest and most important thing that the church has been, certain elements of the church, certainly in America, have been complicit in ignoring. And Bridget, again, it's not a film about losing your faith, and also it's not a film about criticizing any form of Christianity. The bigger church, the showier, more preachy church down the road that's taking his congregation, they're slightly obnoxious just because they're bigger and shinier, but they're not portrayed in a bad light, and their Christianity isn't portrayed as less than his Christianity. Again, I felt that was unusual in not making a comparison, in not making a judgment there. Did you think that was being fair to both sides?
I mean, they were both under the same umbrella, but there didn't seem to be competition between the churches. There wasn't a big...
But one was not more truthful than the other. I think that, again, when the leader, played by Cedric, the entertainment, Joel Jeffers, the other priest, says, you need a pastor as well, you need to look after yourself, he's not patronizing him. He's not acting like his form of Christianity is better. Again, I felt these were layers in a film that another film may not have done.
It's a very uncomfortable scene, actually, when they're sitting there talking, when he kind of confronts him and he says, you know, I don't know if it's that's when he says you need a pastor, or if it's the second.
It's the first time they meet, yes.
Yeah, second time they meet, when he's, you know, the reverend says, you know, you need to go to rehab, and it's quite an uncomfortable scene. It's very well done.
That's the scene where Ethan Hawke allows himself to go slightly melodramatic, and then his character finally breaks down, which was an improvisation on set, I believe.
Oh, okay.
And it wasn't something that Schrader had instructed, but something they settled on was correct for the character after Hawke had presented it. I like the portrayal of the big businessman in this, because I thought originally the film was going to be slightly play that realistically, in that this is the man who's paid for all the church renovation, and we find his head of a big company that's possibly been dumping stuff in the harbour of this town. And I thought, well, this film won't portray him as an out-and-out villain. And then the film portrays him as an out-and-out villain. And then I was slightly, no, wait a minute. If the last year has taught us anything, out-and-out villains are like this. They're unashamedly like Steven Seagal villains. And I like the way that there's quite a brilliant bit, which again sums up how we see the world today and how villains work today, in that he excuses, this is the big business chap, he excuses all his demonstrable awfulness by pointing at one tiny little quirk of the reverend and saying, you can't judge, which which again is how much the GOP playbook in America at the moment. You can't judge me because you've done this tiny little thing wrong. And it, again, was that too broad? Would it, didn't it need to be subtler in those areas, do you think?
Morgan? I think the kind of overt, almost caricature of like the evil energy man.
Blandness of him. The way he asked for organic apple pie.
Yeah, it really helps us get into Ethan Hawke's mindset. Well, more so than a lot of other aspects of the film, like help us kind of get into his mindset and like justification for the kind of actions that he starts to take. So I think either way it was a wise choice. And I like how it wasn't like a commentary on like a little church versus like a big evil church. It establishes somewhat early on that. Ethan Hawke has his job because of Cedric the Entertainer's character, and so he's always kind of indebted to this church anyway. So he's never really on like an even moral playing ground.
Sorry, Bridget?
And the way they leaven his being an out-and-out villain is everyone else around him seems to accept what he does as being totally normal.
Which it is. That's the thing, that, again, the film. And then we've got to wrap up now, but the fact that this out-and-out villain says this shouldn't be political, the church shouldn't be political, and then we find later on that this church 250 years ago helped in its history hid people on slaves running away on the Underground Railway. The church has to be political, but that raises interesting questions because of course the church is being political now and we wish it wasn't. So anyway it's we all agreed it's an absolutely fascinating film and well worth seeing.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, well, first performed opened yesterday and is now showing at the Arts Picture House, and it is a certificate 15. That is all we have time for on today's show. As ever, the past hour will be repeated tomorrow at 2 p.m., a little bit tidied up by me. Then our podcast will be released on Monday, and that can be found either on our page on the Cambridge 105 website or via iTunes, where, of course, you can subscribe to the show, you can leave a review, and that we're on Twitter and Facebook and all the usual places, though we don't tend to do much on Facebook. We're back in a fortnight's time on July the 28th, where we should have a review of Hotel Artemis, which is a talkative, rather interesting thriller starring Jodie Foster. There's Mamma Mia 2, which is like the first film. All Songs and Sunshine, though now the story goes back to the 1970s. And Mission Impossible Fallout has Tom Cruise in it. It's had excellent, excellent reviews. Apparently very bruising action. And we might review, I think it would be interesting to review Merchant Ivory's Maurice, which is on general release again. And we'll have our first article on this year's Cambridge Film Festival. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.